Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5. Immense progress has been made by police investigating Monday's bombing in Manchester, according to Britain's top anti-terror officer. Assistant Commissioner Mark Rowley says they've made significant arrests and now have a good grasp of the network behind the attack.
The understanding of it is growing day by day. I think we've got our hands around a large part of it. But as I say, we've still got some loose ends to chase down. And we've got fantastic teams of detectives and specialists in forensics and other areas who are working round the clock to do that.
Eight men remain in custody while addresses have been searched in Mossside and St Helens in Merseyside today. Jeremy Corbyn says UK foreign policy contributes to terror attacks at home 3 days after the Manchester bomb. Charlie Max reports.
It was former Labour PM Tony Blair who launched the war on terror after 9/11.
It will be a long struggle, I'm afraid, but there's no alternative but stay the course with it.
But the current party leader says UK foreign policy is fueling attacks at home.
We must be brave enough to admit that the war on terror is not working.
His opponents say it's too soon after Monday's attack to politicise the issue.
I think it is absolutely monstrous.
But he did have the backing of UKIP's Paul Nuttall.
A man who left a homemade bomb on a London Underground train has been ordered to spend 15 years behind bars. Damon Smith, who has autism, built the device that is home, but the timer failed. Theresa May's asked other world leaders to join her efforts to push technology companies to do more to combat extremism online. The Prime Minister's in Sicily for a G7 summit. South Yorkshire Police have agreed to pay Sir Cliff Richard substantial damages over reports naming him as a suspected sex offender. He had sued the force and the BBC over coverage of a raid at his home in 2014. And Nestlé is reformulating the Milky Bar so it has more milk and less sugar. The chocolate maker says the new recipe will mean 130 million fewer calories being consumed in the UK. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. With me for the first hour tonight are three out of the four main candidates for the hotly contested Bristol West constituency in the surprise general election, which takes place in 2 weeks' time. That's Molly Scott-Cato for the Greens, Annabelle Toole for the Conservatives and Stephen Williams for the Lib Dems. Sitting Labour MP Thangam Debonair was invited 3 weeks ago, same time as everybody else, but her office has said she has a long-standing diary commitment they don't want to elaborate on. I wonder what she's up to tonight. If anybody knows, please text me on 07786 952 037, or tell us on our comment page at thisweek.org.uk. Do either of you two know, Annabelle or Molly?
Nope,
where Thangam is tonight? It's a mystery. Anyway, so Thangam has, though, sent in a statement, and I'll read that out now. Thangam Debonair's statement for BCFM, Tony Gosling Hustings, 26th of May. I'm sorry, I'm not able to be at Hustings. I have another event I'm already committed to. Since becoming MP for Bristol West in 2015, I prioritised reflecting the values of people who live here. Whichever way we vote, most people in Bristol West share similar values, caring about the environment, human rights, equalities and the value of diversity. And in my time as your MP, as I've reflected those values in the work I've done on your behalf in Bristol and in Parliament. For example, I've championed human rights as chair of the all-party parliamentary group on refugees, most recently publishing a report on a cross-party inquiry initiated into how we welcome refugees. I've successfully campaigned to ensure all young people get education about sex and relationships, and for government funds to develop a clean air zone here in Bristol. I've secured government funding to develop a clean air zone, and I'm committed to greater investment in renewable energy in order to meet our carbon emission targets and halt climate change. I'm proud the last Labour government introduced the world's first Climate Change Act. So in this election, you get a choice between a Labour government and a Tory one, between fair and not, between funding public service properly and valuing the staff who work in them and not. between investing in renewable energy and not, between an economy which works for the many and one which works for the few. And finally, you get to choose. Do you want a country which is inward-looking, closed and fearful, or one in which our Bristol West values are reflected in our city and in Parliament? No, that wasn't me. That was Thangam Debonair, because she can't be with us at the Bristol West hustings this evening, sent a statement in. Also standing in Bristol West for the Money Free Party is Jodian Rogers. So tonight we're going to do our best to examine some of the key policies where government can make a difference to our lives. Health, education, housing, foreign policy, the Big Brother state, as well as the one discipline by which all the rest live or die. Money creation and what the government do with our taxes. So, as sitting MP, Labour's Thangam Debonair was elected in May 2015, bearing the Green... Beating the Green Party by about 6,000 votes. Former Lib Dem MP Stephen Williams, they beat him by about 11,000 votes and beat the Conservatives by 13,000. But those figures alone don't tell us the whole story. About 63,000 votes were cast for the four main parties in Bristol West at the last general election. So let's look at the percentages. Out of the four main contenders in 2015, Thangam Debonair took 36% of the vote. The Greens 27%, the Lib Dems 19%, and the Tories 16%. Britain's archaic first-past-the-post voting system means most of our votes actually get thrown away, and it means tactical voting is usually the only way to influence the result in the direction you want. Rough figures for Bristol West in May 2015 were as follows: Labour 23,000, Greens 17,000, Lib Dems 12,000, and Tories 10,000. That means, based on votes cast for the four main parties, the Greens were 9% behind Labour, Stephen Williams for the Lib Dems was 17% behind her, and the Tories were 20% behind. Comparing second and third place, the Greens at 9% and Lib Dems around 17% behind Labour. The Lib Dems were almost twice as far behind Labour as the Greens were 2 years ago. But that was then. This is now. Let's start by looking at one of the things likely to be Bristol West's majority Labour voters' minds on the 6th of June, and that's Thangam's role a year ago in challenging Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party after the Brexit referendum. And let's start with you for the Conservatives, Annabel Tall. What do you make of the year or so, almost, of infighting that's been going on within the Labour Party?
Oh, good evening, Tony, and thank you very much for inviting me on the show on this glorious evening. First of all, I don't really, it's not my sort of tactic to dismiss the opposition and to blacken the opposition. I'd rather talk about what I'm going to do and what's better about it. But we can't escape from notice the infighting that's been going on in the Labour Party for the last year. When you've got a party that aren't even showing, the party themselves aren't showing backing to their own leader, you do have to question how on earth they're going to lead the country.
They are now, aren't they?
They are, aren't they? Funny that. Just as you come up for a general election. But I mean, it's very, very obvious that running up to before the general election was called, there was a huge amount of infighting going on within the Labour Party. I can't remember the exact vote. I think 147 MPs voted against their leader. Was that right? Yeah, I think so. So he really... It really is very difficult to imagine how you could form a party to lead anything, let alone a coalition to lead anything, when a large majority of your own MPs don't support you.
Now, Molly Scott-Cato for the Greens. What do you make of this 6 months or so, the leadership challenge to Owen Smith, even though Jeremy Corbyn had just won a resounding majority as leader? It just seems like the MPs and the membership of the party just weren't on the same page.
That's right. We're seeing a situation where the MPs are drifting a long way away from the membership of the party. A lot of people have joined the Labour Party with a desire to see radical change in the country, whereas a lot of the MPs are still living in the days of Tony Blair, it seems to me. So there's a big gulf opening up there. And I'm also interested in Jeremy Corbyn's kind of theory of change, because he seems quite pleased about the fact that he's building this very radical revolutionary party, rather than necessarily attracting the kinds of people he needs to attract to win the election. So, I think his policies are actually very popular, and I would agree with a lot of them, because it seems to mean that he's standing on the manifesto we stood on in 2015, with obviously some changes. And also my question would be, do Labour really mean that? And how many of their candidates actually believe in those policies? But, I like his policies. I think a lot of his policies are popular, like renationalising the railways, which obviously we touted in 2015, like higher rates of tax, so you can invest properly in public services. But the problem is, you don't really know where any of the Labour candidates are, and they don't seem to be very close to where their leadership is. So really, it's a confusing message, I think. And also, you can't help thinking that after the election, whether they're the government or the opposition, they might still be rather confused about what it is they're seeking to do.
Stephen Williams for the Lib Dems, about this time last year, a couple of, must have been probably about July, we had Thangam Debonair saying, really criticising Jeremy Corbyn massively, saying, well, he sacked me, he then re-employed me as part of the shadow cabinet, but he didn't tell me anything about it. I mean, she was publicly criticising him. We've also had Kerry McCarthy talking about Jeremy Corbyn as a kind of a cult leader. So what is going on within Labour? I know you're not from the Labour Party, but how do you see this from the outside?
No, but we're all interested observers of what's going on. And it does matter because the Labour Party is the official opposition. They're the second largest party in Parliament, and they get a huge amount of public money in order to discharge that role. And frankly, they've discharged it chaotically in the last 2 years that Jeremy Corbyn's been leader. And that chaos has come at a time that is very, very important for the future of the country. This election ought to be about, though it's barely been discussed, about Britain's future relationship with the European Union. That's why Theresa May says she's called the election. The Labour Party, as the official opposition, have completely surrendered on that front to Theresa May's agenda, voting to trigger Article 50. We know Corbyn...
But hang on, Stephen, they've surrendered to the majority of the public that
I think what they actually... It was a combination of two things, because what I was about to say was I was in Parliament for 10 years with Jeremy Corbyn. I don't recall him ever saying anything particularly friendly about Britain and the European Union. He spent most of his political lifetime campaigning for us to be outside the European Union. A lot of the hardcore of Labour MPs who nominated him for the leadership, and the very small number that did so, would fall into the same camp. And, of course, a lot of Labour constituencies, particularly in the Midlands and the North, voted to leave. So I think a lot of Labour MPs were running scared of their constituents. But anyway, the Labour Party in Parliament has failed to oppose the government on Brexit. The Liberal Democrats have done so. Before Molly says so, Caroline Lucas for the Green Party has done so as well. And we're now seeing in this election Labour offering no real alternative future direction for the country. And that's what really matters. After the election, we know there's going to be a Conservative government. I don't know anyone credible who thinks that we're going to get anything other than that result. But it does matter what sort of opposition we're going to get. And that's why I think we need a very large contingent of Liberal Democrat MPs to have a coherent and united opposition to the Conservative government on the biggest issue of the day, which is our future relationship with Europe.
Well, you've brought us beautifully on to talking about Brexit. Do you agree, Molly, that Brexit is the reason for this general election? There's all sorts of other speculation of what it might be about. And what's your position on it?
Well, I think what's really interesting is that Theresa May called this election from a position of weakness with a majority of 12, knowing that as she goes through the Brexit negotiations, she isn't going to be able to deliver what people thought they were voting for last June. And so she was concerned about selling Brexit to the British public, and also about the economic consequences that are already befalling the country because of our decision to leave.
Brexit's already been sold. The public have voted for it.
Yeah, but they
just doesn't have to sell it.
No, but it was sold on the basis of a system of promises, which I don't think can be fulfilled. And I think over the next 2 years, the promises that were made last June will start unravelling. And as people see that, they're going to be pretty fed up with the government. And also we're going to see economic consequences as we're seeing now with rising prices and, slowing economic growth. So all of those consequences, she knew those were coming, so she decided to strengthen her majority. But to come to your question, the interesting thing is now that she's called the election, people realise they've got an opportunity to vote on a whole range of different issues. And they look at the policies that the Greens are offering on, say, much better funding for education and health, and they're starting to say, oh yeah, that looks like an interesting agenda. Perhaps I won't be supporting the Conservatives. And this whole argument about giving me a strong hand to negotiate with the Europeans, I think it was always a false argument, because there's really very little space for negotiation. And instead, what we need, I think, is strong opposition to the Tories on Brexit, and I'm very happy to do that on behalf of the people of Bristol West with my expertise as an MEP.
You're an MEP, yes. Do MEPs really have any power? And what about the Commission? I think this is one of the things people find so abhorrent about Brussels, is when we are fed up with a politician, or in fact anyone in Europe is, we vote them out, we say, we've had enough of you, and then they turn up as a commissioner and they're running the show.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of misunderstanding, actually, about how the European Union works. So at the moment, I'm working on a piece of legislation where I'm actually negotiating. We sit in trilogues. What that means is there's a negotiation between the Council, where the member state governments are represented, represented, and the Parliament, where all the different groups are represented. So I'm there representing the Greens. And then the Commission plays a sort of third role, but definitely the weakest role, kind of helping to mediate between those other two sides. And that's how negotiation, that's how legislation, law, is passed in the European Union. That's a huge contrast to how we pass law in this country, where the government basically gets their way over law. So I would argue that the European Union is actually a lot more democratic, because as a Green, I can have a voice actually changing the way law works, which I wouldn't be able to have as a Green MP.
Annabel, I must ask you about this Brexit. Yep. Is that the reason for the election, and what's your position on it?
I mean, it was quite clear. Reason the general election was called was for Brexit, but I think there's a couple of things I need to make absolutely clear. It's too late now to rerun the arguments, because we are now leaving. We've triggered Article 50. What a lot of people don't realise is that the negotiations actually start 11 days after the general election. So what we're facing here, and I know it's been hammered home to death about the strong and stable government, but we are facing a government led by Theresa May that's been preparing for this ever since the referendum vote was taken, or we've got the Labour government and Corbyn that we've just been talking about, propped up by the Liberal Democrats and the Greens, who don't seem to be able to agree quite what they want out of it. And you've said the words for me, so I don't know if that was picked up, but Stephen has said it for me. I'm not going to say it, but if I had to make a choice about who I wanted to lead my country, because you can bet the other 27 countries are going to be fighting their corner, and we don't just want an exit that's good for the for Britain, we need an exit that's good for the EU as well, because if they go down, we go down with them. So it's got to be a win-win result.
I think Annabel's demonstrating very clearly there the way the Tories just have never understood how European politics works. Going in there with a big stick or a handbag or something is not the most effective way of getting a good deal. Jeremy Corbyn would be perfectly competent to negotiate this on our behalf, because he has friends in socialist governments right across Europe. The Tories have no friends. They left the biggest group in the European Parliament. They've alienated most of their possible colleagues there. In a negotiation, rather than relying on your handbag, you rely on your friends and making coalitions with people. And I'm sorry that the Tories have burned all their boats, and so Theresa May will not be a useful negotiator for us.
The trouble is, maybe you can answer this, Stephen, is that there are actually lots of secessionist movements right across Europe. It's just that Britain happened to be given the option. I mean, for example, in Italy, in Spain, Germany, France, if we'd had the National Front elected in France, they would almost certainly got the opportunity to vote to leave. Isn't this a club that is really past its sell-by date?
No, absolutely not. I think it's a club that
Why not give people an opportunity to vote like we had here?
Let me finish. It's a club that is more and more essential in what is a dangerous world still. I think if you're going to solve humanity's problems, whether it's climate change, whether it's terrorism, very relevant at the moment, whether it's people trafficking, whether you're going to increase prosperity while preserving peace, then we need to work together as nation states. And the European Union is probably the most successful international project in human history in terms of delivering those objectives. My generation, my father's generation, has never had to contemplate going to war, and that's an achievement that should not be taken for granted. But going forward, you say the other European countries could had secessionist movements. Well, the fact is they just had a major election in France, and Emmanuel Macron, who fought the election as a liberal centrist, but overtly pro-European as well, standing up against all the people who were sort of havering in the other major parties, and specifically against the vile agenda of Marine Le Pen, and he won convincingly. And likewise in Holland as well, the Dutch Liberal parties and the Green Party, Left Party, did well in Holland, standing up to the extremist right-wing party in Holland as well. So actually, liberalism, small liberalism and big liberalism, is fighting back in Europe.
Okay, now I want to talk about something which is a bit closer to home, and that is here in Bristol at the Disability and Equality Forum. There is a director of that, it's called Laura Welty, and our sister show Dialect, Arabella, gosh, what's her first name? Anyway, she spoke to Laura Welty about what her fears were and what her interest is in this forthcoming general election for disabled people across the city.
From the disability perspective, the big one that's come up is the issue of social care. Mm. There is a real problem with social care. And I would suggest anyway that the kind of discussions that have happened at a national politics level really focus purely as though the issue was just older people getting older and acquiring impairments. And that's important because their economic solutions that they're proposing for it, no account of the idea of disabled people also being in that, being affected. I'll give you an example. The previous Labour government talked about bringing in a cap where you would get insurance that would pay for the first £70,000 of your social care needs, and then the state would pay for the rest. Well, if you're born a disabled person, who's going to insure you? Right. Well, no one's going to, aren't they? Because it's a guaranteed cert that you'll need support. Similarly, this issue around now saying, well, even if you live in your own home, you're now going to have to effectively mortgage that to a local authority,
yes,
if you want to stay living in it, to meet your social care. Well, again, that's not going to work if someone is going to be needing social care support for several decades rather than several years.
That was Laura Welty from Bristol's Disability and Equality Forum speaking to Dialect's Arabella Wynne. Sorry, I forgot your name, Arabella, at the start there, but Annabelle Tall for the Conservatives. What do you make of that? I know you've actually got a disabled son, I think.
Yes, I was just going to say, I mean, it's one of the reasons I first got into politics. My middle son, is now 18, so he's now in adult services, has Down syndrome. So I've been through all of this at first hand. Yeah, it's very interesting, that report, because there are an awful lot of issues at the moment with social care. And it does seem, from what I was listening there, that it's got very muddled up with the policy the Conservatives announced last week about social care for older people. I don't know the details of how it's going to impact on social care for disabled people, but one thing I would say that's very, very important is there's absolutely no question of anyone having their house taken away while they're still alive and while they're still living in it. And I think that was a very misunderstood part of the policy when it was announced.
Well, look, the obvious question to answer there is, what happens to the rest of the family? People who are left, do they get evicted from the home?
It depends. The home, if the system works like the system works for now, when you go into residential care, which we had to do for my grandmother. I mean, I effectively lost my inheritance. Not that it worried me in the slightest. I didn't feel that the state should be paying for my grandmother's residential care. We had to sell her house after she died to pay for it. And that's been going on for some years now. But it wouldn't have to be sold while any family member was still living in it. It wasn't until it was empty. The people who lost out were me and my sister. But it was her money, so why should we have automatically inherited it when she had a care cost? I mean, it seems to me a very, very socialist idea. But social care, just to talk about social care generally, because it is a real issue, and what I find often with people who I've spent a lot of my time helping people getting social care for mainly with children that I work with at the moment, and what I often find is that they're not in the right systems. They're not getting any social care because they've been asking their GP for it. They've been asking people in school for it. They haven't actually been talking to the right people. And an awful lot of my effort goes into getting them into the right systems. And once they do and they start getting the care provided, they're in a different place. I'm very lucky because I know the system. My son, right at this moment while I'm being interviewed, I have a personal assistant who I pay myself through a direct payment system, who is being paid on money from the local authority so that I can be here now. But many people don't know that's there, and they don't know how it works. And if you're out there and you want to know how it works, you need to ask for a social care assessment.
So it's not that there's just not enough money for it, and that there's been an actual deliberate policy to defund social care?
It's not a deliberate policy to defund social care. It's a question of people not knowing where to go to get the help. And, of course, my colleagues sitting next to me are never going to talk up what the Conservative government have been doing for the last 7 years, because there's a general election coming up. But the reality is we've actually put more than £3 billion of money, of real money. This isn't, you know, cost-based or anything else. Real money has gone into disability, all sorts of disability care and disability issues over the last 7 years. And as a parent of a child who is using those systems, I have to say it's improved beyond measure. since I was using it 7 years ago.
Now, last Thursday, Theresa May announced as part of the Conservative manifesto launch this, what's been called the dementia tax, also the less secure pensions and cuts to the winter fuel allowance. Now, as I was listening to that, I thought, what on earth is she doing here? If she's going to do this, she shouldn't be telling us before a general election. So why has she done all this?
I think it's a question of being honest. You know, honesty has not been received very well,
it's
I don't think.
That we can't afford it.
So we simply can't afford it. And we do need some radical solutions to address some of these problems. Simply borrowing more and more and more money is just kicking the can down the road.
OK, Stephen Williams for the Lib Dems. What do you make of what we've heard about disabled people in here in Bristol's concerns for this general election, and also about the Conservatives' announcement about pensions, the dementia tax and winter fuel allowance?
Well, I recognised Laura's voice when she was speaking. I think we met several times when I was the MP. But it is undoubtedly the case that social care does face a funding crisis going forward. It's the biggest thing that local government provides, not just here in Bristol, but all around the country. And as we know, local authority budgets have been severely cut over the last 7 years, both during the coalition government and more severely, in fact, since 2015. So you have to find a sustainable funding model going forward. Otherwise, social care is going to collapse, and a lot of other local government services will collapse with it. So that's why the Liberal Democrats are saying in this election that what we would do is put up everybody's income tax by 1%. So the basic rate, the higher rate, and the top rate would all go up by 1p in the pound in order to raise an extra £6 billion, both for the NHS and for social care as well, in order to get an intermediate solution to the financial crisis. But in the medium term, what we want to do is to have a specific dedicated tax that funds both the NHS, integrate that with social care so that you don't get a lot of the mismatches that currently exist in between, for instance, hospital discharges and people being cared for in their home when they're ready to go home. You need to integrate social care hospital services much more than they are at the moment. But you need to integrate the funding as well and have a nationally based tax in order to make sure there is stable and sustainable funding for social care, rather than letting it carry on as it is at the moment, being funded by a dwindling local government grant from central government, and putting more pressure on council tax, which is a regressive tax compared to income tax.
Molly Scott-Cato for the Greens. Social care, what would you do?
Well, I visited the Home Farm Trust home in Richmond Road in Montpellier this morning. I had a really lovely visit. It's a beautiful home where 18 people with learning disabilities live. I mean, it was a lovely day, so we spent a lot of time in the garden. But, you know, that's an example of really good social care. And what they told me, which I think perhaps a lot of your listeners aren't aware of, is the fact that a third of the social care budget actually goes to adult social care. So we often think of elderly people, but actually a lot of the social care we're talking about is precisely people with mental and physical disabilities. And we have pledged that we'll repeal the Health and Social Care Act because, as Stephen said, that has led to significant cuts and reduction in the quality of services for the very people I was meeting this morning. They were explaining to me how difficult it is to continue to provide that service and how they're constantly having to make up for the cuts in their funding. And we've said that we'll put in $7.5 billion a year for this free social care for people like, you know, with disabilities, but also for elderly people. And we'll fund that through changing pension tax relief so we don't give tax breaks to people on higher incomes to save towards their pensions. And we also think that we could save money between $4.5 and $10 billion from ending all the endless contracting there is over social care and the NHS contracts, which we just think is a waste of money to keep the internal market going. And you could run the whole thing a lot more cheaply if you didn't have private contracts.
Another issue has got to be for people in Bristol. Thousands of people turned out last Saturday on College Green, really seriously concerned, including many professionals, teachers, etc., about education cuts. They came in there. Thousands, says Bristol 24/7 website. Children, parents, teachers, governors, union members, politicians and pressure groups all protesting education cuts. The actual extent of these, it's difficult to tell, but we do know that many, many teachers are being cut. We know things like there are appeals being put out now for parents. Please, please give us some money so that we can get books for our schools. Annabelle, really, you know, this surely is not acceptable in the seventh richest country in the world, the Conservatives cutting education.
Yeah, this is one area. I was at an OVO debate earlier this week where I did say this is one area where I would absolutely come out and fight against these cuts. Since the OVO debate, the government has made a statement to say that no individual school is now going to be see a budget cut as a result of this funding formula rearrangement, which is what they were trying to move funding from inner city schools out into rural schools and rebalance it. It's clearly not working. Lots of people like me within the party are complaining about it and saying, you know, you can't just run a school on less money. The costs are pretty fixed. So, I mean, they have made a statement to say that the reduction in education wouldn't happen. But what I would have wanted to was to have been there in the government at the time all these things were being discussed. So I would be in a position to be able to make all these comments that have now been accepted and taken on board.
What about you, Molly Scott-Cato, for the Greens? This does seem like it's really seriously affecting schools to the point where headmasters and headmistresses are tearing their hair out, just trying to literally make ends meet at the end of the day.
Absolutely. I think it's really cut to the bone going beyond that now. I've just come actually from a picnic with parents in Minor Park where they were meeting to express their concern and to meet together to campaign against these cuts. And I was also on the march on Saturday. And what was interesting about that march is that it wasn't the usual sort of rent-a-mob protesters. It was parents and their children very concerned about what's happening to schools here in Bristol. I mean, my niece goes to Redland Green School, and so I've seen the email that was sent to her parents, you know, actually just saying, we won't be able to keep the teachers unless you make a direct debit every month. But we're living in a country where we pay for public services through taxation, and that means that the cuts have gone too far, and the Greens are absolutely committed to reversing those cuts to education. The parents were telling me today that actually they now have a class of 28 five-year-olds with no teaching assistant. They cannot take children to the toilet. Children are wetting themselves in the classroom because they can't leave the other children to take them. It means that the kind of education they're having is severely limited because they have to be very disciplined, even with five-year-olds. So it's increasing the stress on children. I mean, it's called the new funding formula, and it's supposed to be a fair funding formula, but it's not fair at all. It means 1,000 teachers lost in Bristol, and I think it's just a cover for cuts, and we should increase taxes on richer people and invest properly in our schools.
Yeah, Stephen Williams for the Lib Dems, the slightly creepy thing about this is it looks like money has been taken out of the cities, which are mostly Labour voting, and put into the rural areas, which are Conservative. But anyway, what are your thoughts about what can we do about these cuts?
Yes, I know it's creepy. Tony, that's not quite the word I would use, but it's certainly an overt transfer of money away from urban areas into counties. And there was a lot of pressure when we were in government during the coalition for this to happen, but we resisted it at that time. And the school budgets for those 5 years that we were in government were protected, and the NHS budget was protected as well. In the last 2 years, though, the Conservative majority government on their own has made cuts to the school budget, and the Liberal Democrats would reverse those, and we'd also protect going forward in real terms school budgets going forward, and in particular would continue to invest in the pupil premium, which is one of the things I'm most proud of from the time that the Lib Dems were in office. It's a policy I helped to write when we were in opposition. That's the pupil premium, which puts more money into the hands of head teachers to help every child who's on free school meals or has another need. And that was making a huge difference in Bristol West schools that I was visiting in the last few years that I was in office. It was enabling every child in a class to go on a school trip and for no one to be left behind, enabled every child to learn a musical instrument of their choice, so you get rising aspirations and parity of esteem amongst children. And of course, if they needed it, they were getting one-to-one tuition to get them back on track with their literacy and numeracy as well. Lib Dems have always believed in investment in school-age education. That's where you make a difference in society. So that's why in this election, we're saying over the Parliament, we'd invest another £7 billion in school and FE college budgets, and we'd find that money by raising corporation tax back to 20%, but we'd also cancel some divisive Tory education projects such as introducing grammar schools, which will cost hundreds of millions of pounds, total waste of resources, but more importantly perhaps very divisive in society as well, and we'd stop that.
Now let's move on to look at housing, because I've noticed, I don't know if anyone else has, that certainly in London and other parts of the south of the country, house prices seem to have hit a kind of high, and they're now starting to dip in London, other places like that. obviously not everyone is going to have a mortgage, own their own homes, but start with you this time, Molly Scott-Cato. Everyone needs a house. For many, many people here in Bristol, it's just almost impossible to even get a roof over your head.
No, absolutely right. And we are in the middle of a housing crisis here in Bristol. And I think there's been an awful lot of attention for a long number of years now about that idea of getting your foot on the housing ladder. But for a lot of people, that's just not realistic. And our policy in this election is focused very much on people who rent their homes. I think they're the most vulnerable, both in our city and in many urban centres across the country. And I've been, I went on a demonstration last Saturday with Acorn, who are a really useful community group here, campaigning for more power for renters. And the sort of things that they're talking about are the kind of things we've got in our manifesto. For example, allowing local authorities to control rents so they don't get completely out of hand, and at the moment it's just supply and demand and landlords can charge what they want. Also requiring landlords to have a licence before they can rent their property so they have to meet basic standards, and ensuring that tenants can have long-term tenancy so they're secure in their properties. And also the other side of this, I think, is to make sure that local authorities can build the housing that they need. And what's held them back here is the fact that they haven't been able to borrow that money to invest. And I think it's really important that we don't constrain local authorities who want to build that council housing. And actually, in the end, it's cheaper for them to do that, because it's cheaper than having homeless people or people who need housing in worse quality accommodation. And it gives those people the security, and ultimately they will get the income through rent. So I think, you know, the housing market is a mess, and it isn't really a market, and it hasn't worked well for a long time. And, you know, it's largely to do with the creation of money, in my view, and not to do with providing homes for people. And I think we need to remove the focus from kind of homes as assets, houses as assets, and think about them as secure homes. And that's why renting is really important here as well.
Now, when you own your own home, Annabelle, it's easy enough when the house prices are going up, but once they start to level off or start to fall, no one's going to take out a mortgage in those sorts of situations. What are your thoughts about solving this housing crisis? We simply don't have enough places to live.
Yeah, just very quickly going to pick up on what Molly said, because I think we're sort of singing from the same hymn sheet there. I too would like to see an end to this obsession with buying a house as soon as you finish college or university. I know my son now is 21, and most of his friends seem to expect that they're going to leave and they want to buy a house. Well, I didn't. I don't know if you lot did.
But surely the point is people want to get on the housing ladder early so they can own their own home eventually, you know, when they get into their 50s or something.
25 years is the average mortgage, so you can sort of begin to panic by the time you're 40. No, you don't need to panic, because a lot of the things Molly was saying that we could do, we're actually already doing. We have got a white paper going through at the moment. Well, not at the moment, because Parliament's suspended, but was going through before Parliament was dissolved, which is proposing exactly what Molly was saying, which is three-year leases, which gives people in the rental market stability. I've got a lot of friends who rent, and you know, and knowing that you've got only a six-month lease is very destabilising. 3 years is far more reasonable. And also to remove the tenants' tax, which is what the landlords charge when tenants first move in. So that make the whole thing a little bit easier to do. But when we're looking at the buying market, there is a point where people do want to buy a home, and we've got a number of schemes that have been fantastically well received, very well used, and we're running them here in Bristol. So we've got a right to buy scheme, and we've also got, desperately trying to remember the name for it, Help to Buy. Thank you very much, Molly.
I think actually that should correctly be called Help to Sell, shouldn't it? But it's aimed at the house building companies that have built houses, but they're not selling.
But they do allow. I mean, one of my friends has recently bought a house on Help to Buy, and went through the savings scheme part of it, where they rented, and while they were renting they saved, and they were getting, I think, 25% uplift from the government on everything they saved in order to put down a deposit. The house price inflation, house prices, I was checking these this morning, are still going up in Bristol. I think we could probably do in Bristol with them not going up quite so sharply. Bristol is it's a very inflated housing market at the moment. But it is one of the problems.
Pretty much the whole of the south of England. Anyway, Stephen, what's Lib Dem thoughts on housing? How to get more homes and how to fix the bubble, effectively?
Well, first of all, on tenant rights that Molly and Annabelle have talked about, when we were in government, I was the Minister for Housing Regulation and Tenant Rights, and we put in place a lot of reforms to skew the balance in favour of the tenants. There are now ombudsman schemes for tenants to complain about letting agency practice. There has to be complete transparency about the fees arrangements, and as part of that, a clause was put in saying that if landlords and agents didn't stop charging tenants fees, they would be prohibited within 12 months of those regulations taking effect, and that's about to happen. So that's all down to the Lib Dems when we were in government, and actually me in particular. Going forward to protect tenants, and the private rental sector is huge in Bristol West. It's about 50% of households. It's the largest, along with Westminster and the City of London. It's the largest proportion of homes in the country are in the private rental sector in Bristol West, so it's enormously important in this constituency. Going forward, we would legislate to allow for three-year contracts, so people do have that certainty, not only about the period of the tenancy, but also to have a guarantee from the start how much the rent is likely to change over that period, so they don't get sudden shocks. We'd also provide for a state-backed deposit lend scheme so that people really can get their first run on the ladder. But of course, most people don't want to rent. They actually do want to own at whatever stage in life, Annabelle, they do it. I think most people in a free society do actually want to own and control their own future and destiny with their own home. And the only answer to the house price bubble that we've all seen over the last 30 years is to build more, because our population has increased, and the rate of house building over the last 20 years, no matter who's been in office or whatever the economic cycle, hasn't kept up with that. We need to build at a rate of about 300,000 units a year in order just to stabilise prices and rents rather than see unsustainable increases going forward. We won't be able to do that if we leave it up to the current market. So it does require state intervention, both for local authorities to directly build council houses for social rent, but also for the state to directly commission with housing associations homes of all different types, homes for sale, homes for managed private rental schemes, which is the norm in most of our European fellow European countries, and to reinvest the surpluses made from that activity into building more homes for affordable and social rent, and that's I think a sustainable way forward.
Now let's have a look at terrorism. Obviously, with the attack on Monday in Manchester, this is in a lot of people's minds, but the security services, the Daily Telegraph report, missed several opportunities to stop the Manchester bomber. We've heard that the people over in Manchester actually reported this guy Salman Abadi to the anti-terror hotline a few years ago several times, and the main point here really is to try and tease out from the main parties what is their response to this terrorism. And I know today Theresa May has been speaking at the G7, I think, about trying to limit the ability to radicalise people on the internet. In other words, to stop the use of Facebook, Twitter and social media and just ordinary online websites to spread this kind of radical material. Jeremy Corbyn, though, spoke earlier today about this, and it was the first time he's spoken since the attack, and there was a sort of moratorium on campaigning in the general election. So let's have a listen to what Jeremy Corbyn had to say earlier today.
At home, we will reverse the cuts to our emergency services and police. Once again in Manchester, they proved to be the best of us. Austerity has to stop at the accident and emergency ward and at the police station door. We cannot be protected and cared for on the cheap. There will be more police on the streets under a Labour government, and if the security services need more resources to keep track of those who wish to murder and maim, then they should and they will get them. We will also change what we do abroad. Many experts, including professionals in our intelligence and security services, have pointed out the connections between wars that we've been involved in or supported and fought in other countries, such as Libya, and terrorism here at home. We must be brave enough to admit that the war on terror is not working. We need a smarter way to reduce the threat from countries that nurture terrorists and generate terrorism. That's why I set out Labour's approach to foreign policy earlier this month. It is focused on strengthening our national security in an increasingly dangerous world. We must support our armed forces, Foreign Office, international development professionals and diplomats, engaging with the world in a way that reduces conflict and builds peace and security. Seeing the army on our own streets today is a stark reminder that the current approach isn't really working so well. So I would like to take a moment to speak to our soldiers on the streets of Britain. You're doing your duty, as you have done so many times before. I want to assure you that under my leadership, you will only be deployed abroad when there is a clear need and only when there is a plan that you have the resources to do your job and secure an outcome that delivers lasting peace.
Well, that's Jeremy Corbyn speaking, the Labour leader, earlier on today. We don't have Thangam Debonair, who's the Labour candidate for Bristol West, but we do have Annabel Tall for the Conservatives. Annabel, Theresa May is telling the G7, Google and Facebook, this is her main reaction, it seems, must do more to fight terror. And yet Jeremy Corbyn's approach is different, isn't it? He's saying the war on terror simply isn't working.
I mean, first of all, I think I have to say, and I think everyone would share the sentiment that the attack in Manchester was just utterly appalling, sickening, cowardice against... You know, I've got a child that age. It's just unspeakable. You know, and it's left us all with a lot, you know, very, very great sadness. I was very shocked when I heard Jeremy Corbyn's speech. I feel that it's far too early to make these sort of judgments, and I felt very uncomfortable that he was making a political play out of it on such basic arguments before we really know the details. I mean, I was just having a look a moment ago to see if I've actually got the figures on me, and I haven't, and I wish I did, but if people could Google it or have a look. We have made huge investments in security over the last 7 years, huge investments in GCHQ. We have stopped countless numbers of these attacks from happening. You know, the fact that one has got through is one too many. But to try and create an image that everyone's been sitting back not doing anything for 7 years and just letting these people through is so far from the truth, it just makes my head spin.
Well, to be fair, I don't think that's what Jeremy Corbyn was saying. And also, you do wonder, don't you, if the local people are reporting extremists to the anti-terror hotline, to MI5, they are actually highlighting, saying, look, you've got to keep an eye on this guy, and then we still get something like this. Stephen Williams, what do you make, and what's the Lib Dem take on all this?
Well, a lot of attacks will have been thwarted over the last 20 years or so, and you know, we should remember that many, many people have attempted to attack shopping centres and other places where people gather, and these plots are repeatedly thwarted by our security services. We should be very grateful for the work that they do, often unsung. I mentioned earlier that I was a minister in the last government, and one half of my responsibilities as communities minister was for housing. The other half was actually for community cohesion, and I had oversight of the Prevent programme, so I know a lot about what is done at various levels of government and with other agencies to try and divert usually young men away from radicalisation. There's no magic bullet. Having more police on the streets, which seemed to be what Jeremy Corbyn was saying about police cuts, actually isn't really part of it. It's some basic things like making sure that mothers have access to English language tuition so they're fully conversationally confident and integrated into their communities. It's making sure that people meet people from other backgrounds, having lots of cross-community projects, both interfaith and non-faith-based opportunities for people from different backgrounds to intermingle with each other. And that's the sort of community cohesion aspect of counterterrorism that I worked on, but there is also the surveillance side of it as well. And that's why we've got to be careful with Theresa May, because our experience in government was that she was very keen to push as far as she possibly could to have intrusive state surveillance. And while the Liberal Democrats were in government, we made sure that there were proper checks and balances built into the surveillance that we need. And I'm rather worried now that the security apparatus of the state will demand even more powers to look at what we're up to.
Need to be lots of surveillance on Salman Abidi because he was travelling backwards and forwards freely from between here and Libya, it seems, and possibly even Syria, after having been banned from the mosques in Manchester and also having been reported on the anti-terrorist hotline. One does wonder what more can communities do to tell MI5 what's going on if they still can't keep an eye on people.
Well, no doubt there'll be there will obviously be an investigation into what has happened here, and I suspect that at this moment in time we don't know the full story.
Okay, Molly, what do you make of our anti-terror policy? It doesn't seem to have been working this week.
No, well, I begin by echoing what Annabel said, and we were both at the vigil at the fountains the day of the attack, and as usual, you see that the best of humanity there, people showing their real compassion with people in Manchester.
I mean, this is one thing that we do in Bristol, isn't it? When a big event happens around the world, people just go down to the centre. It seems actually a great way of expressing, you know, people's solidarity with each other and understanding that something important's happened.
I think showing solidarity, you know, from one of our great cities to another, people really felt the need to do that, as well as for the individual parents. But I mean, Thangham's not here, so I will say I think Corbyn made a great speech today. I think he's got real integrity on this issue. He's had the same position for a long time, and his position effectively is if you provoke conflict abroad, it will come back and hurt you at home. And
it's called blowback, I think, isn't it?
I think he's right about that. You know, I think he opposed the Iraq war. The Green Party opposed the Iraq war. I think it's caused huge destabilisation in the Middle East. I think we abandoned this idea of using the UN and international cooperation and diplomacy for some kind of freelance foreign policy during the Blair years. I think it's done untold damage to the stability of the world. I mean, I'm a Quaker myself, so I absolutely think you need to look for the causes of wars, and I think we are causing these problems ourselves in the way our foreign policy works. But I'd also like to say, to add to your point about Bristol and the cohesiveness of the community here, there was a great event last weekend where the Wade Street Mosque was open and they invited people in, and they had a lot of leaflets there, you know, Muslims against extremism. I felt very, very proud of the fact, firstly, that they were opening their space so we could find out more about what actually Islam is all about, and also that they were very much opposing these extremist elements in their midst. So I think there's a lot to work with here, but my main concern, I echo what Stephen said, I'm very concerned that the first impulse of perhaps the Conservatives or perhaps just Theresa May is to clamp down on our freedoms, and I think if we allow that to happen, then we are doing the terrorists' work for them, and we must defend the freedoms that they're putting under attack.
Do you want to just address that one quickly, Annabel, because Theresa May is threatening to create a new, we hear in The Independent earlier this week, a new internet that will be controlled and regulated by government. Do you think that's necessary?
Yeah, I think, as I've said before, it's far too early to jump to any conclusions about what's happened here and to any quick fix solutions. I mean, I work on the internet, I work on social media, and the idea of clamping down on the internet is something that's not so easy to do. But I do think that we can do more on specific areas of the internet. The very, very popular things like Facebook, very popular applications that people use, there's far more we can do. And my one that worries me a lot is an application called WhatsApp that is completely secure end to end, and there is no way that any of our security services can find out what's going on it. But we do need to balance that, and I echo what Molly says, with individual freedoms. You know, we don't want a big brother state, we don't want to live in an Orwellian society, nobody wants that.
No, and just a little bit of detail of what Theresa May is saying when she says we are going to create a new internet which can be controlled and regulated by the government. Senior Tories confirmed to BuzzFeed News that the phrasing indicates the government intends to introduce huge restrictions on what people can post, share and publish online. But look, we haven't got long, so we've got to talk a little bit about the economy and the Institute for Fiscal Studies today. I'll let you start here, Molly. The Tories and Labour are not being honest with us, they say, about the costings for their manifestos.
Well, perhaps we should start by saying how extraordinary it is that the government is not costing its own manifesto, that the Conservative Party has decided not to do that. I mean, I've sat there with Andrew Neil as a representative from a small party being harangued about my figures, and the fact that you can come forward in a brazen way and say, well, we're not going to tell you what we're going to cut, and we're not going to tell you what taxes there'll be, and we're not going to tell you how we're going to afford our spending, I find just absolutely gobsmacking.
Well, to be fair to Andrew Neil, he absolutely harangued Theresa May last Sunday.
Well, so he should have done. So he should have done.
Well, we're watching again that one on the BBC iPlayer.
I think the Conservatives haven't come clean. I think this is because the damage Brexit is doing to our economy means that they will have, that you know, we've got a really difficult few years ahead of us. On Labour spending plans, I mean, my own view is Labour have set out a very clear direction of travel here. And a lot of it, as I said previously, chimes with what Greens were suggesting before. So much higher rates of taxes on wealthy people, being much more careful about making sure companies don't avoid paying their taxes, and using the money that you generate through those taxes to invest in better public services. I mean, the Greens would add in a specific wealth tax, and we'd also add in a financial transactions tax, so all that money that gets made in the city makes more of a contribution to, you know, to ordinary people's lives. But the truth is, you can't always be sure exactly how much money any tax will bring in, because the economy is a dynamic system. So you make your direction of travel clear. You're honest about the fact that you think being part of a civilised society means paying sufficient taxes to fund your public services properly. And then, you know, once you're in government, you adjust what you're doing. I mean, the Conservatives came into government and twice they followed that they promised to reduce the deficit, but actually they followed Labour's spending plans. And since they came into power, the deficit's gone up from just under $1 trillion to $1.8 trillion. So, you know, they haven't kept to their spending pledges. So
I just want to, Annabelle, yeah. So we're coming up to the 6 o'clock Murdoch news. So, Annabelle, look, just one thing I really want to put to you is this whole business of getting rid of the winter fuel allowance. For example, we're told that it actually could cost more to stop winter fuel allowance to wealthy people because it costs so much to means test these. Yeah. It just doesn't seem to have been properly looked at and costed at all.
Yeah, I just have to correct one thing, though. The deficit has come down. The debt is going up because we still have a deficit. And
I
the only way
that.
Of getting...
That's
you
what
said
I
the
said.
Deficit was... was
no, I said the debt has increased.
The debt is increasing.
Anyway, what do you make of the criticism for the Institute of Fiscal Studies today?
With the winter fuel allowance, I've always felt that the winter fuel allowance is a fundamentally unfair tax anyway. I mean, my parents, who were, you know, perfectly comfortably off, get a £300 cheque through deposit now in their bank account every year that they don't need. So I think it's something that particularly out, you know, when you're talking to people, when you're door-to-door campaigning, is something that's come up a lot in the past. It's, you know, why is everybody getting this when they simply don't need it? I mean, quite frankly, my preferred method would be to ask people to donate it back. But sadly, in this world, people aren't as nice as we'd like them all to be. And if we were, we could... probably find some Liberal and Green policies might work.
Stephen Williams for the Lib Dems. I mean, at the end of the day, we can't do any of this unless we have a big pot of money. How are we going to get that pot of money, and how are we going to find the money to spend on the things we want?
Well, I tweeted the Institute of Fiscal Studies very simple graph earlier today, so I invite people to look at that, which shows, actually...
I'll put a copy of it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I'll have a look at it.
Please do. And it shows, somewhat surprisingly, actually, that the most progressive and socially fair proposals put forward are actually by the Liberal Democrats, not by the Labour Party, because the Labour Party is not proposing to reverse some benefit changes that we are proposing. Their tax plans are predicated entirely on thinking that you can get all the money you need from companies and the very richest and most wealthy, which no one else thinks is credible. Whereas the Liberal Democrats are having the courage to say in this election that we should put income tax up by 1% for every income taxpayer. That's about 55% of adults. Obviously, the poorest pensioners and workers don't pay income tax at all, so they are protected. But for the 55% of people who do pay income tax, we put it up by 1p in the pound to make sure the NHS does get that extra £6 billion
a
year.
But these people will just go offshore.
No, they won't. And that's why the IFS says that our plans are credible, because the vast majority of people who pay income tax aren't able to avoid it in the way that you've just said. But the very super rich are able to find ways to avoid it, and that's why you must continue to tighten up on tax avoidance. But you can't fund everything out of those people.
There's a new EU savings tax directive I worked on that means they can't send their money offshore without you tracing it.
That sounds like maybe Linton Crosby should check that. It's actually an interesting story.
We can transfer it across with the Great Repeal
about Linton Crosby. Crosby, the Tory spin doctor, actually keeping quite a lot of his money abroad. Anyway, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guests from the Bristol West general election in 2 weeks' time, Molly Scott-Cato for the Greens, Annabelle Tall for the Conservatives, and Stephen Williams for the Liberal Democrats.
From the Sky News Centre at 6.